Evening, everybody. Let's start by cultivating our motivation. And again, rejoicing at the opportunity that we have to listen to teachings. That between last week and this week, we haven't been born in the lower realms or lost our precious human life. And we haven't been so distracted by other things going on in our worldly life that we've forgotten about the Dharma since then. So we have the opportunity to listen and to contemplate. This opportunity is nothing to feel arrogant about, but rather to feel fortunate about having and not take for granted. And therefore really have a strong intention to make good use of it. And so to do something other than just continue the same old suffering as usual, the same old eye-grasping as usual, the same old self-centeredness as usual. And have a strong determination to transform our motivation to one that benefits all beings. And then to want to attain enlightenment so that we can do that most effectively. So generate that intention with a real feeling of care and affection and love and compassion for others. Not just with putting up with them, but genuinely caring about what happens to them and wanting to work for their benefit. Okay, so last week we were talking about equalizing and exchanging self for others. This is Shantideva's method for generating bodhicitta. And so we were talking about the equalizing part, and we got through the 6 points that have to do with the conventional level. Okay, first point. Everybody wants happiness and to be free of suffering equally. Second point. The example of the 10 beggars, and so they all want something. Why should we discriminate amongst them, thinking one's happiness is more important than the other? Third point? Okay, so the 10 patients who are all suffering and wanting them to be free equally from our side. Okay, and then the next point? Okay, everybody's been so kind to us. Do you really believe that? Some days, not every day? No? Do you believe you've been kind to others? Oh, yes! I've been very kind. Have they been kind to me?
No.
Oh, that's interesting. All those people who have been... We live in a place where... We've been so kind to other people, but nobody's been kind to us. I wonder who all those people who think they've been kind to other people, who they've been kind to. Because nobody seems to have received much kindness. Very interesting, huh? Okay, and then the fifth point. Okay, so we've received more help from harm. And what's that in response to?
They've been kind, but...
Yeah, okay, so they've been kind, but they've also done... Okay, and then the sixth point? Okay, so since we're all going to die, what use is there in holding a grudge? That's an important one to really think about very seriously, you know, because when we hold a grudge, you know, that's setting ourselves up to die with anger. What happens if your mind stream is dying with anger manifest in it?
Lower realm.
Lower realm. Okay. What kind of karma do you create when your mind stream has a grudge? You're creating negative karma. Okay. So grudges are really bad deals for us. Yeah, because we create negative karma as we're living them and holding on to them, and then if they manifest at the time of death, then they act as a cooperative condition to send us for, you know, for our mind to be attracted to a horrible rebirth. Yeah. So it's really important because, you know, some grudges are really bad. We can really identify them. But, you know, every day we go to bed with still some residue anger at somebody. That's a grudge, isn't it? Yeah? Even if it's just a little bit of anger because of what some small thing somebody did to us today. It's still some kind of... Because what's a grudge? A grudge is holding on to the anger, not letting it go. Okay? And if we hold on to enough of these small angers, they become a huge court case against the person. Yeah. And then it's really horrible. Yeah. So it's important really, you know, to forgive other people. And forgiving other people means letting go of our anger towards them. Okay, it doesn't mean what they did was okay. It just means deciding in our mind that we're not going to be angry about it anymore. Now, why should we be angry about it? Well, our mind says, well, they did this, and they did this, and they did this. Okay, but why should you be angry about it? Especially when it's not happening now. It sure does. It reinforces our sense of I very big. And it creates an identity as a victim. Okay? I am this person, this is my identity, who has been mistreated, abused, unnecessarily blamed, da 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 by so and so. And we adopt that victim mentality, and that poisons our entire life. So it's something to be actually quite careful about. Because sometimes we feel like we're holding on to the grudge in order to punish the other person. Our grudge doesn't punish them. They don't even know what's going on. Our grudge punishes us. And it's so sad when you see grudges going on in families. Generation after generation after generation. And grudges are what, you know, cause so many ethnic wars. You know, so much ethnic strife. It's because of grudges, of things that happened centuries ago. And so when you hold on to this kind of grudge, you just teach your children to hate. And is that what you want to teach your kids? And so we also have to look at the hatred that we've inherited in our family. You know, maybe there have been grudges held in our family that we've heard about since we've been little, you know, against some family member or against some other person in the community or against some other race or religion or ethnic group or nationality, you know. All these things that we've heard about since we were kids that somehow got internalized and that we carry with these grudges. Yeah. And so they're really poisonous. Really poisonous. Okay. Okay, so very important to identify them. When you were doing retreat, did you notice some of these grudges surfacing? Yeah? Finding out that you were still mad at people that you thought you were no longer mad at? I remember when I did Vajrasattva many years ago, I realized I was still mad at my second grade teacher for not letting me be in the class play. That's pretty pathetic, isn't it? Yeah? But that's what the child mind does. And then the adult mind, you know, just gets mad at some equally petty thing, but has a bigger reason why it's not petty. Okay? Very important to be on top of these kinds of things. Okay? Because it's very difficult to have love and compassion for people that we're angry at. Yeah? And we all want to cultivate love and compassion. But how can you wish somebody well, wish somebody to be happy, that's the definition of love, if you're angry at them? Because being angry, you want them to suffer. So they're totally opposite. How can we want that? You know, it doesn't work. Okay? So in our mind saying, oh, I want to cultivate love and compassion, but at the same time cultivating hatred and grudges and resentment, you know, we're sabotaging our own spiritual practice. So it's something to really be quite on top of in our life. Yeah, because these things are very sneaky, how they're in there. Okay? So now we're going to go to the last 3 points in the 7 points of equalizing self and others. And so the last 3 points are looking at things from the ultimate viewpoint. So here we're going to start bringing in more of the empty perspective, more of the perspective that things do not exist in the way they appear. So the first point under this is that if there were real, inherently existent friends, enemies, and strangers, like our mind believes, then the Buddha would see them. Okay? Buddha's omniscient, right? Buddha doesn't have any mistaken consciousnesses, not one single mistaken consciousness. So if there were people who were really inherently friends, inherently enemies, inherently strangers, in other words, people who were inherently worthy of our attachment, worthy of our anger, and worthy of our apathy, then the Buddha should definitely see those same people as friends, enemies, and strangers. Okay. Buddha doesn't. Yeah. In fact, they say that the Buddha, if on one side there's a person making offerings and giving him a nice back rub, oh, wouldn't that feel great? You know? And doing nice things. And on the other side, there's somebody else swearing at him and beating him. From the Buddha's perspective, he feels equally towards both these people. Isn't that amazing? Yeah. And you're going to say, on what basis, you know, can he feel equal towards them if one's helping and one's harming? Well, it's because he's not looking at the superficial help and harm. He's looking beyond that. And he's looking into everybody's heart and seeing they all are just trying to be happy. They're all trying to be free of suffering. They don't know the causes of happiness. They don't know the causes of suffering. And so they're just doing the best they can. Why have hatred and attachment towards them? Okay? So the Buddha is able to see that these categories of friend, enemy, and stranger are completely constructed by our judgmental mind and our self-centered mind. Totally fabricated by our mind. Okay? On what criteria? Somebody does what I like, they're a friend. Somebody does what I don't like, they're an enemy. Somebody doesn't do either, they're a stranger. That's the only criteria. Yeah, unless you can think of some other criteria. Yeah? I mean, why are people your friend? They're nice to me, they give me presents, they make me feel good, they have the same political views I do, they agree with my ideas, they encourage me when I feel down, they've been kind to me. It's all about me, isn't it? 100%. Yeah. Not just 99%. Yeah, 100%. Why? That's the reason lying behind the attachment. Okay? And why do we find other people disagreeable and enemies? They don't do what I want. They haven't been kind. They've interfered with my happiness. They don't give me presents. Yeah, they swear at me. They discourage me. They put me down. Yeah, or they hurt the people I'm attached to. Now, still, same old thing. It's all about me, isn't it? So that's our reasons for resenting other people. And for being apathetic, well, they don't do anything towards me, so they aren't even worthy of notice. Kind of the way it is, isn't it? Yeah? Did you think about the people in Benares today? Anybody think about the people in Benares? The people in Pathankot? People in Chiang Mai? Yeah? People in St. Louis? Yeah. Do we think about living beings, other living beings? Did you think about all the fish in the ocean today, what they're experiencing? Yeah. Did you think about all the insects in Nepal? Huh? You see? You know, there's all these living beings, and from their own perspective, because they have this feeling of I like we do, you know, their whole world revolves around them. To us, they're totally non-existent. We don't even think about them. Yeah? And so it's as if they aren't even sentient beings. They're just maybe numbers or, you know, they're part of this all sentient beings that we work for, but, you know, we don't really think of all sentient beings. Okay? So we really have to look past that. Yeah?
When I'm doing the loving kindness meditation, I find it really easy to have a sense of loving kindness towards non-human sentient beings.
Oh, yeah.
More challenging.
Oh, definitely. Okay, so you say, when you do the loving kindness meditation, having loving kindness towards animals and insects, much easier than human beings, isn't it? You know, we go outside and the turkeys, you know, they're so cute, or the kitties, or the squirrels, or the chickadees, and, you know, all the animals, so much compassion for them. But human beings, yeah, that person who ate that chocolate chip cookie that I didn't get. Yeah. That person who didn't do their chore. That, oops, I looked on the list that actually was my chore. You know, we get so mad at them. So mad at them. Yeah. We're so judgmental. We have such, like, so many criteria about how everybody else should act and how they should think and how they should treat us. Now, our mind is just full of shoulds. And then, of course, other people don't do what we think they should do. How terrible they are. Yeah. And so we just kick them out of our field of love. So if we start out, let's say we have a room that we have all sentient beings in because we love all of them. And then as they do things that we don't like, we show them the door. Okay? Finally, who's going to be in that room with us? nobody. We're going to be sitting in that room alone with all of our hatred and all of our judgmental mind, because we have kicked out everybody else because they haven't met our perfect, immaculate, pure expectations of what they should be. Yeah? So who's suffering because of this? We are. We are. You know? We think we're punishing others. Oh, you didn't treat me properly. I'm going to show you. I'm just going to ignore you. You know? You didn't treat me properly. I'll show you. I'll talk about you behind your back. You know? We think we're punishing people. Are we punishing them? No. Who's experiencing the negative effects of our anger, our hatred, our resentment? We are. Yeah. So similarly, you know, if somebody else talks badly behind our back, who's experiencing the negative effects of that? Are you sure they are? Aren't we experiencing the negative effects? They're talking bad behind my back. How dare they? My reputation's going to be ruined. And if my reputation's ruined, then I won't get a job and I won't have a partner and I won't have friends. I'm suffering because they talk behind my back. Right? That's what we tell ourselves. Isn't it? Do we really believe that they're the ones suffering when they talk badly about us?
Do we really believe they're talking about us?
Yeah, they're mostly talking about themselves. We think they're talking about us. Yeah. So this is something also, you know, when we find out somebody's criticizing us behind our back, we have to really think at that time, you know, how suffering that person is, that they are sabotaging their own happiness by talking badly about us. Yeah. And really think about that so that we don't hold any grudge against them. And we don't fall into our old mind of, but, you know, if they talk bad about me, I'm going to suffer because I won't have da 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 da. Do you see how we have different double standards about things? Yeah? And how we interpret everything through the perspective of me. Hmm? So really in Dharma we're trying to totally transform that. Yeah? I'm not punishing anybody else by ignoring them, by being angry at them. I'm punishing myself. Yeah? When they're talking badly about me or ignoring me, they're the ones who are suffering, not me. Okay? This is totally the opposite way than how we usually feel. Totally the opposite. That's why it's called practicing Dharma. Okay? Because you see, if our usual perceptions were to be trusted, then why do we need to practice the Dharma? Yeah? If our usual perceptions are 100% accurate, if our usual emotions are 100%, you know, justified, then there's no need to practice Dharma because we're already perceiving reality and we're already having the suitable emotional reactions. It's true, isn't it? Yeah, it's true. Yeah. So, you know, when we come to Dharma, we have to come with the perspective of, I need to change. And I need to question my own perceptions. And I need to question my own emotions. Because if we come to the Dharma with the viewpoint of my opinions are right, then how can we ever learn the Dharma? Our opinions are already right. So everything everybody says, even, you know, the Buddha comes in front of us. If the Buddha says something we don't agree with, we say, what kind of teacher are you? You don't know anything, buddy. You know, my ideas are right. So then what happens? Yeah, then we're really in a pickle, aren't we? Yeah, even the Buddha appears in front of us, tries to help us, tries to teach us something, and we think, you know, he's nuts because his opinions are different than mine and he doesn't treat me the way I think I should be treated. Yeah. Buddha has 5 million disciples, but he doesn't pay any attention to me. Huh. See, that's the way we think, don't we? You know? If Buddha only appeared in front of me with his magical powers, then I would have faith. Oh, what kind of Buddha is he that he doesn't, you know, do this so that I can have faith? That's the way we think. Okay? So if we're really attached to our own opinions, then useless to practice the Dharma because we're already right. And if things exist as they appear to us, and if all our emotions are the only possible way to feel, and all of our emotions are the right thing to feel, then who needs the Dharma? We're already right. We must be already enlightened. Then why are we so miserable? Yeah? Okay? So something's wrong in this picture. Something's wrong. If we're really as right as we think we are, why are we so unhappy? Yeah. I remember you telling the story when you went to couples therapy that the therapist said to your partner, you can either be right or you can have a good relationship. You have a choice. There's two choices. You can be right or you can have a good relationship. What do you want? That's it, isn't it? Yeah? So if we cling on to being right all the time, boy, oh boy, you know, we're not going to have very good relationships. So when we hear in the thought training teachings about giving the victory to others, this is what it means. It means, you know, gagging that self-centered thought that is always saying, I am right, and the world should recognize it. Yeah. Okay, so the first point here is that the Buddha doesn't see any real friends, enemies, and strangers. That, you know, these do not exist in the perspective of the Buddha. And the Buddha has no mistaken consciousnesses. Okay? So if we see an inherently existent friend, enemy, and stranger, or an inherently existent person worthy of our attachment, worthy of our hatred, worthy of our apathy, then, you know, then compare your cognition to that of the Buddha. Okay, second point. If friends, enemies, and strangers were inherently existent, you know, object of attachment, object of hatred, object of apathy, if they were inherently existent, then they couldn't change. So the person who is now a friend would always be a friend. The person who is now an enemy would always be an enemy. The person who is now a stranger would always be a stranger. Is this the way it happens? No. Yeah. I think international politics are a scream when you look at that. You know, the U.S. used to be supporting Osama bin Laden. Yeah? Isn't that amazing? Yeah. Then we were fighting Germany, you know, kind of 60 years ago, a little bit more than 60 years ago. Now Germany's our best friend. Fighting Japan, you know, in our parents' generation, now Japan's our best friend. It's just amazing. Yeah? How things change in international politics. And they change similarly in our own personal relationships, don't they? Yeah? People who we were best friends with, you know, who we loved, now we don't even speak to because we're so mad at them, or because they've become strangers. Or people who were strangers now become friends or enemies, or enemies have become friends or strangers. Everything changes. But if friends were inherently existent, and enemies were, and strangers were, then these relationships would be cast in concrete and unable to change. Okay. Why? Because something that is inherently existent does not depend on other factors. Something that is inherently existent is independent. Something that is independent does not depend on other factors. Something that does not depend on other factors doesn't depend on causes and conditions. Okay? Something that doesn't depend on causes and conditions cannot change. It is fixed. And no matter what changes around it, it cannot change. Because it isn't influenced by causes and conditions. But that is not our experience, is it? Yeah, things are so changeable all the time. Okay? Then the third point. And this one I really like, you know, because here, up until now, we've often been talking about friends, enemies, and strangers, and once in a while, including ourselves in there, who's more important, me or the others, but we often tend to keep it nicely outside. Okay, maybe we can equalize friend, enemies, and strangers, but who's more important, me or others? I am, you know. Okay, but this last point actually hits that. But before I get into this last point, His Holiness always talks about that, you know, like this is a conventional way of talking about who's more important, self or others. Okay, so if we were to have a vote, okay, there's me, and there's all sentient beings, and who's happiness is more important, mine or all sentient beings? Who do you vote for whose happiness is more important? Okay? If we were really being democratic, we would vote for all sentient beings minus one, wouldn't we? Because of the power of the majority. But who do we vote for? Me. You know, and yet we go around saying we believe in democracy. We don't believe in democracy. We believe in dictatorship with ourselves as the dictator. Okay? But if we really believe in democracy and you were to have a vote, whose happiness is more important? One person or infinite sentient beings minus one? Infinite sentient beings minus one. So how can we justify going through our lives saying me, 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 me? Yeah? I'm most important. Everything has to go the way I want it to be. Doesn't make sense. Okay, now back to this point. Okay? Discriminating between self and others, if self and others were inherently existent, so that we could say, I am more important because I am inherently me, and others are less important because they are inherently other. Okay? If that were true, then, well, not if it were true, but that can't be the case because self and others depend on each other. In other words, we can't identify self without identifying other, and we can't identify other without identifying self. Those two things depend on each other. Okay? So it's like this side of the valley and that side of the valley. Okay, you look across the Abbey, we have Spring Valley Road, Spring Valley, and we have mountains on the other side. Okay, so there's this side and there's that side. But if you went to that side, which would be this side? That side would be this side, and this side would be that side. So is this side, or that side? It depends. So when you say I and others, yeah, when you say I want happiness, okay, where's that I that wants happiness? It feels like there's only one I, doesn't it? And everybody else is other. But from the viewpoint of other, that is I, and we are other. So are we I or are we other? Am I me or am I other? Okay. I remember when Sirkin Rinpoche was teaching this, because that's what I learned this for. Alex was translating, and this whole thing about this and that and self and others. And we were all roaring with laughter because Rinpoche kept on saying, are you I or are you other? Yeah. And Alex was going, and Rinpoche, you don't know who you are? You know? Are you I? Are you other? And to really look at it. You know, why when we say the word I, do we put so much emphasis on the set of aggregates? Yeah. Why do we even say this set of aggregates when, from the perspective of everybody minus one, it is that set of aggregates? And from the perspective of everybody minus one, it's other. It's not me. Okay? So, you know, when we're trying to decide who's more important here, me or other, am I really some inherently existent I? So that when I say I'm more important, it always refers to these aggregates? From the perspective of others, others refer to the to others' aggregates. So when we say I want happiness, it could be everybody minus one wants happiness, couldn't it be? Okay. So that's exactly the philosophy behind exchanging self with others. Yeah, is you just exchange where you label I. Because you realize that I is merely labeled. Yeah, and other is merely labeled. And so this set of aggregates could just as easily be that set of aggregates, could just as soon be other and not be I. And from the majority view, it is other. It's not I. Okay. And so then why when we say I want happiness, does it just refer to these aggregates? And when we say others, you know, want happiness or others aren't quite as important, it refers outside. Why doesn't it refer to this one here? Yeah? Because I and others are equally labeled independent upon the perspective, just as this side of the valley and that side of the valley are labeled, just dependent on the perspective. Very interesting to think about this one. Especially when you have some pain, because the mind, you know, when we have pain, goes, I'm suffering, I, and there's just a strong feeling of I, isn't there? I'm suffering, this huge I is suffering. Yeah, but from the viewpoint of everybody minus one, it's somebody else is suffering. Yeah, somebody else is suffering. So can you imagine, you know, lying there? Yeah, when you're sick, saying somebody else is suffering. Looking at your own body, as somebody else's body is uncomfortable. Somebody else has hurt feelings. Yeah? Very interesting. What would happen if you said that? Yeah? Somebody else's feelings are hurt. Yeah, you get a whole lot of space, don't you? For as soon as you say, my feelings are hurt, boy, you know, there's no space at all. Somebody else's feelings are hurt? Oh, that's too bad. They'll get over it. Won't they? Yeah? Other people always get over hurt feelings. It's not a big deal. They're just being too sensitive. Yeah, somebody else is just being too sensitive, just being, you know, easily offended, just interpreting everything from a very self-centered view. Yeah, just give them a while to calm down. They'll come to their senses and see their perceptions are totally off the wall. That's what we think, isn't it, about other people? Well, try applying other to the set of aggregates. Yeah? Oh, somebody's in a bad mood today. No, who cares? I'm going about my business. If they want to be in a bad mood, let them be in a bad mood. You know, somebody else's stomach hurts. Oh, what a pity. What's for lunch? I'm in a good mood. I'm not going to let their stomach ache bum me out. Yeah, try thinking like that. Oh, somebody else didn't get what they want. Oh, that's too bad. What else is new? Okay, so the exact way that we treat other people now, that way, we just exchange the I and others because they're merely labeled. Yeah, so you just exchange it. And then, you know, how we usually think about others, then you start thinking that way about yourself. I want to be happy. Oh, wow, look, there's so many eyes that want to be happy. Yeah? And so then we start looking at everybody's eyes. When we say, I want to be happy, it means everybody else. Yeah? I don't want to work overtime today. Somebody else can work overtime. Except the I is your colleague. And the somebody else is you. Yeah. I don't feel like cleaning the toilet. It's not my chore. Yeah. Yeah. Somebody else can clean the toilet. Okay, so somebody else gets up, goes and cleans the toilet. Because it isn't that person's chore. Yeah, somebody else can do it. So we get up and do it because we're somebody else, aren't we? You're going to say, oh, this is not psychologically healthy. This is dissociating. Yeah, you're a therapist. Isn't that what they say? Oh, you're dissociating.
Confused.
Yeah, you're confused. You don't know who you are. Yeah. You don't have a big enough sense of self. No, it's not dissociating. This is done for a specific reason, and it's done with wisdom. It's not done because of psychological problems. Yeah, this is done with wisdom. Realizing that I and other just completely labeled. Yeah. Okay. Come back to the text now. Okay. So we're on the subheading that says, what is to be given up by contemplating the disadvantages of selfishness? Okay. And so here is one of the phrases in the mind training. Okay, banish the one to blame for everything. Okay, that's something we should remember. Banish the one to blame for everything. So, let's say there's one thing that is the source of all your problems. Yeah. That when you look around, something that's all making you continually miserable, that's what you're going to banish. Isn't it? Banish the source of all your suffering. It just so happens that the source of all of our suffering here is the self-centered mind. Yeah. But we talk, banish our self-centered mind? Oh, who's going to take care of me if I don't take care of me? Yeah. And actually, there's even a saying in, what is it, you know, if I'm not for myself, then who will be for me? If I don't take care of myself, who will take care of me? Even the psychologists, even the religious people, they say to take care of yourself. I like that one. Okay. But you see, the way we normally take care of ourselves is actually damaging us. Okay. So if we really want to take care of ourselves, we take care of others. That's what His Holiness says. Yeah, He says, if you want to be selfish, be wisely selfish. And the best way to benefit yourself is to take care of others. Yeah. Do we believe that? Only if the others are people that we're attached to, who we know are going to be nice to us in return. Aside from that, okay. Do you see how our normal way of thinking is completely capovolto, upside down? You know, completely. Yeah, totally upside down. Yeah. Okay, so Namkhap Pel's commentary about banish the one to blame for everything. We sentient beings run after misery that we do not desire and never achieve what we wish. But we think we're running after happiness. But we're actually running after suffering, which is what we don't want. And we never achieve what we wish. Why don't we achieve what we wish? Because we're going about it the wrong way. At the root of it all, we seek to lay the blame elsewhere, which is a mistake. Isn't that true? Whenever we're unhappy, what happens? We blame somebody else, don't we? Yeah, we blame somebody else. Why am I unhappy? They did this, or they didn't do this, or they should have done that. But, you know, why am I unhappy? It's always somebody else. Yeah. Or once in a while, we blame ourselves. But when we blame ourselves, we do so also in a very unrealistic way. Of, I'm so powerful, I can make everything go wrong. Yeah, why did this marriage fail? It's all my fault. My fault. Yeah. Why don't nobody love me? Because I am so terrible. You know, that's totally an inflated sense of self. Totally. We are not that powerful. Okay? At the root of it all, we seek to lay the blame elsewhere, which is a mistake. This is because all the various lengthy and violent sufferings that come from being born among the five or six kinds of existence, from the hell without respite to the peak of existence, that's from the lowest hell realm to the highest God realm, these are not without causes, nor do they arise from unrelated causes. In other words, what we take rebirth as, the happiness and suffering we experience in a rebirth, is not without causes. It has causes. And the causes are not unrelated causes. They're causes that have the power to produce the result that we're experiencing. Okay? So blaming, you know, something that is an unrelated cause for our suffering is totally crazy. Yeah? It's like when we plant the garden and pumpkins grow, but we wanted sweet peas, so we blame the pumpkins. Yeah. And we blame the pumpkin seeds. But, you know, they have nothing to do with it. Okay? I mean, I'm sorry. That didn't make sense. We blame the sweet pea seeds because we thought we planted sweet peas, but we get pumpkins. Yeah? Okay, so we're blaming a discordant cause like sweet peas and thinking that the sweet peas grew the pumpkins. They didn't. The pumpkin seeds grew the pumpkins. Okay? So, these come about independence upon the actions and disturbing emotions that give rise to everything. So why are we born in any of the six realms of existence? Due to afflictions and karma. Okay? Since actions are caused by the disturbing emotions of the afflictions. Okay? So remember, the actions we do are what produces the result. What causes the actions are the afflictions. Okay. Since actions are caused by disturbing emotions, the afflictions, disturbing emotions are the primary factor. Moreover, amongst the disturbing emotions, it is the ignorance that grasps onto a misconception of self that is the principal source of all misery. So that self-grasping ignorance, yeah, that thinks the I is truly existent, that thinks the I exists from its own side, that self-grasping ignorance is the source of all the other afflictions, which are the source of the karma, which brings the rebirth in the different realms of cyclic existence. So this cause and effect series, this is very, very important to understand. And very important to remember and to keep in mind. Okay? I mean, this is really crucial because if we don't remember this, then what do? We blame outside for our suffering instead of realizing that the suffering in cyclic existence, our being born in cyclic existence, comes from karma. Karma comes from the afflictions. Afflictions come from the self-grasping ignorance. Okay? So important to remember that. So it's not God. Can't blame God. Yeah? Can't blame the president. Can't blame the terrorists. Yeah? Can't blame your neighbor. It's the self-grasping ignorance. Okay. The Guide to a Bodhisattva's Way of Life, who was authored by Shantideva, says, however much torment, fear, and suffering there are in the world, it all arises from misconceptions of self. In other words, from self-grasping. Oh, what trouble this great ghost brings for me. Okay? So if you want to believe in ghosts, you know, because we usually think of ghosts as something that you can't see but harm you, biggest ghost is the self-grasping ignorance. Yeah. We can't see it because it doesn't have form, but it's the source of all of our trouble. Furthermore, since disturbing emotions, chiefly created by seizing are grasping onto a misconception of self. In other words, thinking that the I is independently existent. Yeah. Since that brings us harm, those afflictions bring us harm, they are the actual adversary. Okay? Our own mental afflictions are the actual adversary. We should not maintain relations with this long-term antagonist. Okay? If somebody is consistently cheating you, robbing you, and beating you up, yeah, do you maintain a good relationship and invite them in your house for tea? No. So whenever this self-centered ignorance, or self-centered ignorance's best friend, the self-centered mind, yeah, whenever this couple show up, these are the long-term antagonists. And we should not have a good relationship with them. We should try and harm them, because they harm us. So the same text says, thus, through long unbroken contact, he is our foe. So he, meaning the self-centered thought and the self-grasping, sole cause of an ever-increasing heap of trouble. When we are certain of this in our hearts, how can we be happy and unafraid in cyclic existence? Okay, so when we realize that all of our misery in cyclic existence comes about through the internal enemy of our own self-grasping ignorance and its best friend, the self-centered thought, when we realize that's the source of all of our misery in cyclic existence, how can we be happy and unafraid in cyclic existence and just twiddle our thumbs thinking that everything is going to be hunky-dory? When the chief adversary, the chief destroyer of all of our suffering, lies in our own heart and mind. You know? Huh?
Chief destroyer of all of our happiness.
Yeah. Lies in our own heart and mind. It's not other people who destroy our happiness. It's our ignorance, our self-centered mind that destroy our happiness. What was that slogan that we had on the thing? When there is suffering, there is self. Okay, that's the meaning. When we are suffering, there is big ignorance grasping at I, and there's big self-centered thought. Yeah. But it's so funny, when we're suffering, we never remember that, do we? We never remember that the enemy is in here, and all we have to do is change the thought. Yeah, that's all it requires, is changing the thought. But it's the last thing we think of doing. Because we're so focused on it's outside. Okay? So we're going to stop there this evening. Anybody have any questions? Yeah.
It seems so obvious as we go through it that way. Is it just our habituated way of being that makes it so hard to turn that thought?
Yeah. Okay. So it seems so obvious. You know, when we talk about it reasonably, it's totally obvious, isn't it? Yeah. So you're saying, is it just our habituated thought that makes us look at it in a totally different way? That's it. We are so habituated with ignorance and with self-centeredness. Yeah? So those two thoughts, and then our long-term familiarity with them. And so, you know, it's like you might be in a horrible marriage, totally dysfunctional marriage, but it's so familiar that you're terrified to leave it. So we are married to our ignorance and our self-centeredness. Yeah, it's totally dysfunctional. But we can't face looking at the truth of it, because it's so familiar. Yeah? then you really, you know, when you really see this clearly and you think, you know, this is the state of every single sentient being. Yeah? That it's just the own, everybody's own thought that imprisons them and keeps them trapped in suffering. It's just the thought. You know, doesn't that make compassion come in your mind? You know, because then, I mean, that's why it's like, it's just the thought. It doesn't even, it's nothing solid. It's nothing external. It's nothing that has to be there. You know? There's some expression, I remember Lama Zopa talking about, it's on the tip of a thought. You know, the tip of a thought. How do you have a tip of a thought? But it gives you that image, the tip of a thought, you know? You could just change something so quickly, can't you? A tip of something is so small, you just, and it's, you flip it around like a tip of a blade of grass, and, you know, it's changed. It's the tip of a thought. You just change the thought, and the whole thing changes. But we don't think of it. And when we think of it, we're so attached to our old ways of thinking. We're so totally immersed in it that we can't see how it's wrong. You know? So like you said, you know, when I talk about it now, when we're all in some kind of, you know, emotion state where we don't have a very strong emotion, nobody's harming us, it's so completely logical, isn't it? How the real enemy is the ignorance and the self-centeredness. But when we're angry or when we're attached, if somebody else came up and said to us, you know, this is all because of your self-centeredness and ignorance, what are you going to say to them? Yeah! Oh, my! What do you know, Buster? You know? It's amazing how much our whole perspective changes 180 degrees when our mind is under the influence of an affliction. 180 degrees. So that what we see as true right now, yeah, when we're in a very emotional state, we cannot see that as true. And in fact, we get totally, you know, furious at anybody who even suggests that that is true. Yeah? And yet, when we're in a calm mood, it makes so much sense, doesn't it? You know, and we can see it in our own life. All we have to do is just change that thought. You know, then the whole experience could change. But somebody comes and says, change your thought? Oh, change your thought! Don't you tell me what to do. You're telling me to practice Dharma? You practice Dharma! That's what we think, isn't it? You know? Just what we like. Yeah?
There are two questions from the internet.
Uh-huh.
One of them is from Lily, who is 6 years old, and she wants to know why animals are so scared.
Oh, so the question from Lily, who's 6 years old, who wants to know why animals are so scared. It's because they're very ignorant, and they can't, and they're trying to protect their own life. And so they see sometimes beings that are trying to help them as harming them. You know? Like when we go out sometimes to feed the squirrels or feed the turkeys, they run the other way. Yeah? And they run the other way because some people do want to hurt them. But they can't tell that we're not those people. They're blinded by their own ignorance, so they can't see that we want to help them. Yeah? So it's pitiful that all the animals are afraid, isn't it, when we have a good heart? But when somebody wants to harm them, it's good they're afraid, because then they run away. Good question, Lily.
The other question is, might be a little bit longer answer. Last week there was a question about the silliness of expecting others to repay kindness. And this person was wondering how this relates to our expectations that the urge to repay the kindness of others naturally arises in ourselves.
Okay, so somebody's saying that last week we were saying how silly it is for us to expect somebody else to repay our kindness. But on the other hand, we're saying that when we meditate on the kindness of others, very naturally a wish to repay their kindness comes. Okay, so how do you put those two together? Okay. So when we're kind to others, others may very well have that natural wish to repay our kindness. But just as we were talking about the animals being afraid because they can't distinguish help and harm, sometimes human beings are the same way, and they can't distinguish help and harm, and they're ignorant. And so somebody may be helping them, but they don't see it as help, and they see it as somebody harming them because of their own ignorance. And so rather than the natural wish to repay the kindness coming up, they have resentment or anger coming up. That's why. So when we meditate, we want to make sure that we see others' kindness and we're not blinded by our own ignorance and our own self-centeredness. Because ignorance and self-centeredness do make us blind to seeing others' kindness. That's why we have to do this meditation, really taking anything, take any object that is around you and trace back the number of beings that were involved in you having use of it, and you see the kindness of others. Why do we have to deliberately do that meditation again and again and again? Because we are obscured by our own ignorance and our own self-centeredness. And things turn up in front of us, and we just think, well, of course, I'm the center of the universe. So that's our own ignorance, our own self-centeredness. And that's why we have to do that meditation, to see the kindness of others, so that our natural feeling of repaying it will come into our own mind.
Mm-hmm. So, when I'm fully into this and I'm on my way out, the conscious point that I was trying to explain of where I go, why is it always me that's wrong? You know, and I think it's the thing of not separating out the person from the self-centered thought.
Right. Okay.
So, like, what's really working for me well, I have to say, is it was coming up naturally now, and I'm a little farther along, is just that it just comes up now. Stop blaming others. And when that comes, it turns.
Mm-hmm.
Great. And I don't necessarily just shove it all on myself, but there still comes this place of this kind of resistance.
Okay. Okay, so you're saying that that sometimes, you know, you're just saying, why is it always me that's wrong? Okay, if I can't blame others, then I've got to blame myself. Why does it always have to be me who's wrong? You know, well, that we're thinking that way because we're confusing the conventional I with the self-centered thought, whereas the conventional I and the self-centered thought are two totally different things. Mm-hmm. So we're confusing them. Also, we're working from the erroneous paradigm that there has to be blame. And if it's not somebody else, it has to be me. Now, who set up that rule of the universe? That there has to be a person to blame instead of a thought.
Yeah, and I think I actually noted that a little bit, but I actually think slogans are very helpful with this.
So what? Slogans? Yeah.
So I think I need a reply. And that thing comes up, like, why is it always me? I need to just have like something like, stop blaming anyone.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So you're saying when that one
comes up of why is it always me? Like, why is it always me who's self-centered? That I'm so unhappy because I'm self-centered. Why is it always me who's self-centered? Why isn't the other guy being self-centered?
Because I analyze them out. I know they're not the problem. And then I'm like, well, darn it, why do I have to be unhappy?
Yeah, why do I always have to be wrong, you know? And then to say to yourself, why does anybody have to be wrong? Yeah, you don't have to blame a person for this. Okay. Yeah.
Oh, my mind keeps going, well, if I take care of everyone else like I take care of myself, I'll be busy all day long and I won't take care of myself
mm-hmm.
properly.
Okay. So if I take care of everybody else as well as I take care of myself, then I won't have any time to take care of myself. You know, I don't think everybody wants you, you know, rummaging through their room and cleaning out their drawers and brushing their teeth and, you know, doing those things. Okay? So, you know, please take care of yourself and that way. Yeah? So I'm not talking, taking care of others doesn't mean that we mind others' business in an inappropriate way. That's not the meaning of taking care of others. This is another, remember how we talk about near enemies? This is a near enemy. The difference between taking care of others and minding others' business. Because we get them so confused. And that's why we don't understand why people don't appreciate it when we're trying to help, because they see us as meddling. Because we are meddling, but we're thinking we're being kind. Okay? So we have to distinguish these things, and one of the chief distinguishing things is what is the motivation? Yeah? Okay?
That's taking care of others, then your enemy can be micromanaging.
Yeah. Right.
I'm thinking on, like, it's study time. I'm going to go and put out medicine meal so that the person that has medicine meal doesn't have to put it out mm-hmm. and lose some of their study time.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, now that I've done that, I think I'll go and vacuum the floor for the person who was supposed to vacuum the floor. Like, my mind keeps saying, okay, then I need to be doing these kind of kindnesses all day long.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's never a time where I'm taking care of myself and that.
Yeah, okay, so it's study time, but you're vacuuming the floor for the person who didn't and setting up medicine meal for the person who didn't and everything like that. Well, then you have to see, is this something that's happening repeatedly or is it something where somebody forgot? Everybody forgets things once in a while. If you go and do their chore for them because they've forgotten, that's fine, and, you know, that's comfortable, and it's very kind. If somebody's repeatedly forgetting to do their chore, you're not being kind to them by saving them. Okay? Because they need to learn to be responsible. And in that situation, being kind would be to bring up at the community meeting, you know, I've been setting out the medicine meal day after day because everybody seems to forget it. Is this, you know, is this the way people want to have it in their own practice where they forget their own chores? Okay?
But not even them forgetting, but wanting to repay their kindness through whatever means.
Okay, so wanting to repay their kindness through whatever means they can. Your studying is also a way of repaying their kindness, because if you study and learn some Dharma, then you're going to be able to help them. Okay?
May the spiritual teachers who lead me on the sacred path and all spiritual friends who practice it have long life. May I pacify completely all grant such inspiration, I pray. May the lives of the venerable spiritual masters be stable and their divine actions spread in the 10 directions. May the light of Losung's teachings dispelling the darkness of the beings in the three worlds always increase. Due to this merit, may we soon attain the enlightened state of Guru Buddha, that we may be able to liberate all sentient beings from their suffering. May the precious Bodhi mind, not yet born, arise and grow. May that born have no decline, but increase forevermore. In the snowy mountain paradise, you're the source of good and happiness. Powerful Tenzin Gyatso mercy. May you stay until samsara ends. May the deeds of explaining and practicing the Dharma done by groups supporting the teachings and their upholders who spread the view of dependent arising and nonviolent actions in the 10 directions, and especially at Shravasti Abbey in the West, glorious.